The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 9, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. So first of all, I just want to thank you all again for being part of Sesshin. Sesshin is people doing Sesshin. Like, there isn't really a Sesshin and then people pop in and pop out of it. There just is people doing Sesshin. So without you being here, there really could be no Sesshin. And it is a problem that we've struggled with at Dharma Field a little bit, where people will stand back and say, is there a Sesshin going on? And they're not part of it. So as long as you don't Sesshin, as long as you don't participate, you don't act in Sesshin, then there is no Sesshin. So again, thank you for being here. I think it's an important part of practice, which is one of the reasons I really wanted to try to keep the schedule going if we can. And I think, you know, just any interest is really almost all we need to keep it going. But this practice of settling in and really paying attention to our minds, that's what my talks are going to be about for the next few days. But Sesshin is a really important part of that. In Thursday morning study groups, we've been reading Charlotte Joko Beck's Everyday Zen. And somebody keeps pointing out to us, you know, she's at Sesshins. She's talking about the practice of Sesshin. All of the talks that she gives that are transcribed are Sesshin talks. And there's just something that, I don't want to say that happens, but there's just something about the nature of Sesshin that is very, very important. So important that every talk in this book are her Sesshin talks. So again, thank you for being part of this. I'm going to give talks for the next few days from Steve's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think. And one of the reasons I looked at this book was I just haven't looked at it in a while. It was a book I read way back when I first started taking up this practice, and I'd always meant to come back to it. And I found some really excellent essays. So today's talk is going to be about the essay, The Problem with Eradicating Evil. And the title just popped out to me. And I think you can see why. You know, this is really an alive topic right now. This is something that has a lot of juice, a lot of energy to it when we look around at the world. I have a friend, I'll talk about him again in a second, but his facility, the speed with which he ascribes something as evil, gives me whiplash sometimes. And I can see the bad behavior, usually political, that he's pointing to, that's problematic, that is causing pain and causing confusion, and that people are engaging in just for their own self-interest. I see that, but the word evil comes out of his mouth. And once it does, there's like, well, I'll tell you what he told me in just a little bit here. But it's not just him. It's really everybody, in a way, are, you know, the concern of eradicating evil, of living in a world where whatever it is that we're thinking of as evil no longer is something that we have to deal with, that we're living in a moral, settled, not crazy world. So yeah, just this friend, this same friend that has this tendency to ascribe evil, he sent me right after I started working on this talk and thinking about how essential it is, how much conflict is in the world because people stake out their territory, point to the other person, say that's evil, and then try to do something to eradicate that evil. And there's a whole slew of things that humans have done to each other to do this. But as I was starting to prepare this talk, I got this message from this friend. And he was referring to this Facebook picture that had shown up from years ago when he and I were both hanging out together a little more than we do. Wow, that was pretty dramatic. So this is from our, you know, our history. And in the photograph, friends of ours are imitating this guy who had a big role in all of our lives at that time, and one we didn't relish, one that we actually had problems with. But he had a big role in our lives, and he was very abusive in the way he would mete his power out. You know, so the fellow they were referring to was not a nice guy necessarily. He could be. He could be very nice. Very, very nice. We'll talk a little bit about this problem of evil. This guy could be incredibly generous, and then he could turn around and crush you. I mean, that was part of what made it so difficult. And so anyhow, this photograph, and this gentleman who had been such a big part of our lives passed away within the last year, I think. And so my friend wrote me and he goes, you know, it's funny that picture's up because I was just thinking how happy I am that that guy's dead. And it took my breath away. I couldn't believe I was really reading it, even though, again, he's very quick to ascribe evil. But this guy's a nice guy. He's a very, very smart. And he's concerned about inequities and injustice in the world. And we are on, you know, you get to those teams, those beliefs you have. We're on the same team, basically. So when he sent me that, I was like, wow. And I thought it was he was confiding in me, you know, because it seemed like such a thing to say, that we engaged in a message exchange for a while about what he was saying to me. And I realized he really wasn't confiding in me. To him, that was just, yeah, you don't feel the same way. Okay. I kind of thought you did. It was really striking to me. And after we had our exchange, one of the things I thought about was I appreciated his candor, you know, that he would actually say that. Because again, I certainly, if I felt that way, I don't know that I would tell anybody that. And I'd even asked him, I said, why did you tell me this? Just curious. I said, I'm not asking you to defend what you just said, but why did you tell me this? And thinking about it, I was just thinking, you know, his candor, his ability to just say that is really at least to be admired, because I think that eradicating evil is probably deep inside of a lot of our hearts. And that may include wishing bad on people who we think are evil, even if we won't admit it. I'm not that kind of person. I don't think like that. But push comes to shove, watch the logic of some positions that you might hold very strongly and see what is the extreme logic of that position you occupy. Because that's how people start to engage in what we might think of as evil, is it seems to be a reasonable place that originally you're occupying, and then, boom, we get out of control and we're in the extremities. But this thing that Steve is addressing is, you know, so I'm talking about, this guy was talking about a person. We can think of evil as just sort of maybe a philosophy or a viewpoint, or it could be a corporation. It could be a particular type of behavior that people have. And we just want to be done with it. We just don't want it around anymore because it's causing all kinds of problems. Harm is ultimately what my friend said was, well, I'm glad he's dead because he's not going to harm anybody anymore, you know. So we just want to be done with harm, with problems, with the kind of troubles that beset our lives. Now, I want to look at the title of Steve's talk, or his article, before I kind of dive into it. The title is The Problem with Eradicating Evil. Right? And just what I was talking about, we can start to see some problematic stuff just in what my friend said. But there is a whole lot of ways that eradicating evil is a problem. Some of which I think are, you know, the way we'll talk about it, are really in line with the Buddha Dharma. But if we look at that word eradicate, for example, we can see what the problem is, or a problem is, just by sort of the immediate definition of that word. We think about eradicating something. So I looked the word up just to see what the definition was. And simple definition is destroy completely. Put an end to. And I'd say that's pretty much what, you know, if you really look at it, that's what we would like of evil. To just put an end to it. To be done with it. To have it go away. To destroy it completely. And of course, one of the problems we have that I'll be addressing a little bit later in this talk is one of the problems with destroying complete or putting an end to evil is, what are we talking about when we're talking about evil? And evil, I looked that up too, just to kind of see. I mean, I don't know that we really need to look the word evil up, but it's profound immorality and wickedness. That's evil. But I have a feeling we have a more flexible definition of what evil is than necessarily going there. And when we're describing something as evil, what is it that we're doing? You know, are we really looking at that whole, the whole picture? So I just had another friend. They posted a picture. You know that painting of the signing of the Declaration of Independence? Now, the word evil didn't come up, but boy, I felt its presence in the comment about that picture. Because what was weird was all of the people in that picture, with the exception of like three people, had their faces blotted out with red dots. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And they said, the next time somebody tells you about the brilliance of the founding fathers, you know, well, first they said, this picture, we blotted out all the founding fathers who owned slaves. And the next thing was, so the next time somebody holds the founding fathers up as some godlike figures, show them this picture. You know, and I just went, oh, that's kind of interesting. Interesting take on things. And a whole bunch of people approved of it. And I'm not saying I approved or disapproved. That's neither here nor there. But what was interesting to me is the blotting out of those faces. And in the name of the fact that they engaged in this evil and slavery, if we're going to put the label evil on something, it's pretty easy to see slavery as an evil, right? And so those who engaged in it, well, are they evil? And this is a good question. And this is what part of the problem with eradicating evil is that what is it that we're talking about with evil? And then what does it mean to completely destroy something or put an end to it? This just throws us right back to the precepts, to the first precept, which is a follower of the way does not kill. It's that logic, that idea that we can exterminate something, get rid of it, obliterate it, that is off the path. Because of how it's understanding reality. It's not seeing that what it is that's showing up, Steve's going to talk about this in his chapter, but what it is that's showing up that we're going to label evil, that's totality showing up as such. And you're not going to be able to get rid of it because it's part of reality. It's part of totality. Totality is the total thing. You can't get anything out of here. You can't destroy it. You can't put an end to it. But there is, I thought, you know, when I was looking at that, I was going, but I think eradicate has an etymology to it that I suspect is going to be more helpful for us to see the problem with eradicating evil, perhaps in a slightly different way. And so I looked up the etymology, and the etymology is to pull up by the roots, to pull something up by the roots. So what is it that we're talking about then when we're talking about evil? What are the roots of evil? And that's what I think that common way of eradicating evil, of just destroying this thing that we think of as being wicked or profoundly immoral, that's not looking at the roots. That's not looking at the whole thing. So it ends up being like if you weed, and you know that if you just pull the weed, you just sort of pluck the weed and you leave the roots in, that weed's coming back. There's nothing you're going to do about it. But if we start thinking about, you know, evil, and we start loosening that term up, and we start thinking about, well, what are we talking about when we're talking about evil? And again, people have a whole range of things. Some of it is, it may be ascribed in a book. This is what evil is, right? So I don't want to say that we all have the same definition, and my guess is it changes. But I think, again, we can look at behavior. We can see consequences that we might at least start to find some common ground. And harm, something that's destroying things, something that's killing or ruining, or, you know, that sense of harm is at the heart of it. But still, that doesn't really get us to the root. What is the root of evil? And so how do we uproot evil. So the problem of eradicating evil, I would argue, is also that, well, not only is evil itself a problematic category, but it's the fact that we don't really see the root of the harmful activity that's showing up that we actually want to be rid of. And by not seeing that, we're not actually uprooting the difficulty that's arising. So Steve starts this chapter out with an epigraph, if you know what that is. It's like a little quote that begins a chapter. And this one is from maybe a surprising source for some of you, but it's from Matthew chapter 5, verse 39. And it's a quote from Jesus. And I was surprised at what Jesus was saying, because he says, "But I say unto you that ye resist not evil." Well, I didn't know that. That was something that Jesus said. It doesn't really surprise me from what I've read about Christ that he would not be into this whole, let's eradicate evil, let's be happy that somebody has died. That doesn't sound very Christian the way I understand it. But when I look at a Christianity, sometimes I hear there's like a war on evil that's taking place. And so this surprised me a little bit, just because it wasn't quite jibing with my admittedly ignorant understanding of Christianity and maybe the way that some people ascribe to or take up Christianity. But so we have that. I say unto you, resist not evil. And we're going to talk a little bit about that too, because I think that throws some people. Or they're going, well, wait a minute. So stuff that's showing up that's harmful, that's perhaps killing and destroying things, I'm not supposed to resist that? Again, it's evil that is really the problem. So here's the opening of Steve's essay. He says, "Some years ago, I came upon a beautiful picture, the original image of the three monkeys, hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. They were carved into the lintel of a stable door in 17th century Japan. As a boy, I remember seeing plaster images of these three, but they didn't look at all like the monkeys of old Japan. The figurines I knew were tame by comparison, with all three lethargically squatting and facing the same direction. As originally carved in Japan, however, they were quite dynamic and captivating. All were active, striking out in different directions. Rather than refusing to acknowledge evil, as the more familiar image seems to depict, these monkeys appeared to be scrambling in response to it." That's interesting. I remember when I first heard Steve start talking about the three monkeys. I knew the three monkeys. You know those three monkeys from when you were a kid. And you do. You see these little like plaster figures or drawings or whatever. And what you have the monkeys and it's see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And they're all like looking in one direction. And the way that I always understood that sculpture was that it was describing a bad thing. And that bad thing was that what these monkeys were doing was they were looking out and something bad was happening, but they were too, I don't know, cowardly to address the bad things. So they're pretending like they didn't see it, didn't hear it, and they weren't going to say anything about it. So the monkeys seemed to be engaged in some kind of ignoring of the evil that was taking place in the world, and so actually allowing that evil to continue doing what it was doing. Right? It's just like you see something, you know, you'd hear these. By the way, my understanding, it's a mythological story, not mythological, but definitely misrepresented and did not at all reflect what really happened. But you probably heard that sociology story about the people in New York, I think it was in the 1940s or 1950s, and somebody was being brutally attacked or maybe murdered, and they were all just looking out their apartment windows watching it happen. And nobody was trying to do anything about it. And then some conclusion was drawn. And I have read that that is not at all what happened. But it's the story, and it's the story that we all know. And that's what the three monkeys seem to me to be. You know, look at it and just pretend like you're not seeing anything. Just act like that's not happening at all. The monkeys that Steve's describing, you know, they're seeing something. They're seeing that evil, and they're responding to it. You know, they're reactive. As Steve said, they're dynamic and reactive. Because they're seeing evil, they're hearing evil, they speak evil or speak of evil. And I would say speaking of evil in some ways is speaking evil. It has the same kind of basis to it. So the Eastern take isn't that there's this evil out there that, you know, we shouldn't ignore. Rather, it's that that evil out there, that evil that you're positing that's out there, that is the thing that is the unrest of our minds. I mean, I think it's interesting that there are monkeys that are responding. On one hand, because I think there's something we can immediately picture. You've seen monkeys looking at things, you know, kind of looking and responding. They seem to be very responsive animals, kind of human, looking at things, yelling. So there's something about that. But also there's monkey mind, right? And so you got these monkeys and they're just going crazy to this evil that they seem to be seeing. And I think the takeaway from the Eastern sculpture is different, very different from the Western one. And it has to do with what it is they're looking at. So Steve picks this up. He says, we tend to think of evil as something distinct and separate, especially separate from us, the good folks. And we're preoccupied with keeping it that way. As a result, we often view certain people or cultures or political systems or religions as evil. Indeed, we can decide that just about anything is evil. I remember once being told that Lake Superior was evil because it had taken the lives of so many people. And you know, on one hand, you just hear something like that and you go, what? Somebody said Lake Superior? That happens way more than you think. I heard somebody describing tornadoes as evil once, and I just went, I think we got to define our terms here. But any belief that evil is or could ever be separate from us leaves us struggling to keep evil ever at bay. We see ourselves as divided and separated from experience. We see ourselves as experiencers of that out there. And when that out there seems to please or protect us, we call it good. Similarly, when it appears threatening or strange or terrifying, we call it evil. Thus, our feeling of separateness is precisely what creates notions of good and evil in the first place. And I think that that last sentence really kind of gets at the heart of it again. So our feeling of separateness is precisely what creates notions of good and evil in the first place. Because again, what's good is what's out there that seems to coincide with our ideas about the way things should go. That seems to protect or please us. And what's out there that's evil is the stuff that seems to be threatening us in some way. And the thing with evil in particular, right? So I think Steve is right, that good and evil is predicated on the sense of separation. But evil just seems to really be another name for you're different from me, you're separate from me. Because evil, as Steve pointed out, is not us good folks. And this, again, is a mindset that's very easy to get in, that this is, we're doing it the right way. Right? So we might think of good in a whole bunch of ways, but it might be this is the right way to think. These are the right things to do. These are the right things to say. And the people that aren't doing it are bad, so they're outside of us. Or we could, it might come at us the other way. That stuff they're doing right there, I'm not doing that. My friends aren't doing that. Or the political group I belong to isn't doing that. Or the religious institution that I do is not doing that. So now we hear this and we go, but Steve, it's true. These people lie about this, that, and the other thing. And these people don't lie about this, that, and the other thing. And I would just say, hold on to that. Watch what it is you're doing, because you're immediately engaging in this. But again, these are beliefs to which we ascribe so strongly, which we'll talk about in a bit, that it becomes hard for us to see that we're even doing that. We just kind of go, this is just the way it is. This is how reality works. So the thing about evil is evil's out there and it's somebody else's fault. It's always somebody else's fault when it's evil. When it's out there, when it's somebody that's not from our tribe, so to speak. And again, that's even when we think, well, I don't think that way. People that I'm with don't think that way. Just watch that. Watch that particular position. Because it's easy to do. It's easy to take that up. I do it all the time where I'm like judging somebody and then I kind of go, oh, look what I'm doing. I didn't even realize I was doing that until all that garbage just came out of my mouth. But that way of seeing the world, you know, as Steve says, if that's how we see things, that is a world that's separate from us, this fractured, fragmented world. It doesn't make any sense. And one of the ways it doesn't make any sense is, well, how can there be evil? That is a profound question that people ask. How can there be evil? I remember reading an article? It's a guy that I had reviewed a book of his. It was my first published book review. Was it? We'll just say it was. It was the first published book review of recent. And the guy loved what I said because it was a good review, right? So he wrote me and kind of became a pen pal for a little while. And so he sent me a book of essays. And in his book of essays, he was saying that no moral system or religion is worth anything at all unless it can account for the sheer cruelty of humanity. And he said, unless you can address this, and then he came, imagined some truly horrible thing that actually I think was from history, you know, and he said, unless you can account for that, everything you got to say is worthless, you know. So that's our problem. How can there be evil in the world, right? This world seems to be impossible when it's fractured, when there's evil that is out there for us to ponder, to wonder about, to ask ourselves. And then we, of course, we try to address it too. And as Steve says, if what we do is we see evil and then we try to, how does he say, this might just be keep it at bay. But whatever it is we're doing, yeah. The belief that evil is separate from us leaves us struggling to keep evil ever at bay. So it's just, it ends up being this sort of endless cycle that we get into in trying to eradicate evil the way that, you know, I expressed at the beginning of this talk, to get rid of it, to blow it away. So Steve goes on, he says, were we to see the world as it is, and this see is his italicized seeing, which is objectless awareness. And I'm going to talk more about this in tomorrow's talk. So we'll just leave it at that right now. But were we to see the world as it is, however, thoughts of good and evil simply would not arise. Consider the utter foolishness with which we repeat and feed the cycle. First we imagine complete separateness, then we react emotionally to what we imagine. Then, based on our emotional responses, we fear this, we want that. We imagine mental objects that we call good and evil, but they're not real as we imagine. They're phantoms we've created in response to other phantoms. The problem is a more profound aspect. In our desperation to create and maintain our separateness from evil, in our futile attempts to do the impossible, we create all kinds of problems for ourselves and others. And these problems in turn also get branded as evil. Sometimes we get branded as evil as well. And so the chain goes on. We would rather call down war upon ourselves and others, wallowing and grasping at our conceptual distinctions, than notice the ungraspable world of wholeness and totality that we're already immersed in. And I think that's really powerful. We would rather call down war upon ourselves and others rather than notice the ungraspable world of wholeness and totality that we're already immersed in. And again, that's the logic. That's the extreme logic of this. That's ultimately what we want to do. We got to draw these lines. We can't be like the other side. And once you've really made those entrenchments, and they're deep, that's the ultimate logic of it. But we can just pull it back to I don't know. I'm trying to think about resistance we might have to accepting the fact that stuff that we see that's showing up that we think is crazy or harmful or sick or, you know, whatever words we use, that that's actually us, that it's inseparable from us. That is a line that I think most of us don't want to go there. So when my friend sent me that message the other day, my first instinct was, oh my God. And then I felt like I needed to moralize to him. And I really had to watch that because I wouldn't put it the way he did. But I know that in my heart, I have held that kind of belief from time to time and probably will continue to do so, that I have to be vigilant. Again, I might not put it that way. I might not have gone to the extreme yet of war, but I'm in that place of separateness. I'm in that place of evaluating and making distinctions between what I do and what other people do, and what I do is what's good and what other people do. We do this all the time. This is something we just want to be aware of. We do this all the time, even when we tell ourselves we don't do it. When people tell me they don't do things like that, I'm just like, give me a break. You're a human being. You're going to do it. It's okay. It is okay. But we can watch that we're doing it. We don't have to inflict harm. You know, so even though it's human for us to do this, it doesn't mean that we're condoning it. I say it's okay. I just mean I'm not going to condemn you. You know what I mean? If you find yourself condemning other people and you're saying, see, Steve, you're saying that. And that's absolutely true, because that was one of the first things that came to my mind when my friend sent me that was, it was kind of like, whoa, that's not good, you know. And so it just popped up. So yeah, we create. Well, I think what Steve is clarifying here is that the problem that we're creating is believing that there's a world that's out there that's outside of me, and then what we do is we pay attention to, once we have this sense that there's a world that's outside of me, you know your 12-fold chain of dependent arising. Even if you don't know it, you know this is true. This is the thing about the Buddha Dharma, is that it's always really pointing back to stuff that even just on a relative world scale, without even bringing the absolute into this, you can start to see the wisdom of this. But once you bring in a sense of things being separate from you, then there is going to be what in the 12-fold chain is intention, which is you're going to lean toward or lean away from some of these things. There are going to be feelings that arise. And then you know what's going to happen? you're going to go, that thing made me feel this way. And that thing can be a whole lot of things. It can be somebody else. It can be, again, ideas. They can actually be, emotions or something. You know, we respond to emotions. We respond to thoughts. All kinds of things. So this comes up just out of this idea that there's a world that's outside of me that I am experiencing. And then when we have that world that's outside of me and we have those feelings that are going on, that's what we're responding to. You know, Steve points out here, what's crazy is that it's not that there's something evil out there, it's that there's something that we see that's outside of us, and then we're responding to it at the speed of light, or faster than the speed of light. This is important too, because sometimes when we engage in these talks, it almost sounds like we're engaging, you know, we go through life kind of going, that thing bothers me, and because it bothers me, I'm going, no, what happens is you go, holy cow, that's terrible, you know, and then, or maybe even like, that's evil, I can't believe somebody just said, you know, that kind of thing. It just comes right up. Because that fast, because that's how life unfolds. It's lightning fast. That's why Dogen says, you want to practice suchness without delay. Because it's right here. And whatever the things are that are showing up, they come and go and come and go and come and go. So it's all lightning fast. So we have this world then, and we kind of respond to it, and then we start thinking that there's this thing that's distant from me that's called evil, and I try to keep that thing from me. Again, this is all just coming out of the idea of separateness, and then problems arise as we're trying to keep that thing separate from us. This is what I think a lot of tragic stories are about, great tragedies. I mean, tragic drama, you know, like Oedipus, or to make it more modern, Hamlet, something like that, where you've got a character and they're faced by something and they go, yeah, that's a problem, you know. And so they do a whole lot of things to avoid it. If you think about Oedipus, the fact that, you know, a soothsayer, prophet said, well, you know, this guy's going to kill his father and sire children with his mother. And, you know, they're just like, that's horrifying. So then they bring him to a completely different place, well, to be killed. But, you know, they leave him out in the wilderness or whatever. They're actually supposed to kill him. And the guy leaves him out, and then a shepherd finds him. And so all the things, I don't know if you know the story very well, but then flash forward years later, and Oedipus is the king of Thebes. He's doing the very stuff that he was told that he was going to do, but he didn't know he was told he was going to do it. Nobody knew he was still alive anymore to have done these things. And he's got this plague going on in his town. That's the evil that's haunting him. And he wants to get rid of that plague. And then he's told, well, there's something very wrong in this nation or city or whatever they called it. But there's something very wrong in Thebes, and you're going to have to uproot it, basically. You're going to have to take care of that. And so you know that what everything that happens afterwards is him, the actions he engages in, somewhat hubristically, you know, as he starts to see what is possibly going on here, he just keeps going. Because he's got to eradicate that evil. But anyhow, so that's it. We create these problems in trying to keep our distance from evil. This is what happens. And then as Steve points out, in doing so, we ourselves can be described as evil. And as I was writing this talk, I just thought, well, you know, it's so easy. This is kind of abstract. But I was just, you know, wondered, we can think about some belief that we hold that we might understand somebody else would see as evil. And think about what, now I'm just going to quickly flip it around. You can think about what you would do to protect the thing that you believe in and how people would see what you're doing as evil. And then also look at, since this is more germane to what I was just talking about, notice how the people who are responding to the thing that they see that you're doing or that you believe is evil, notice how the actions you're doing to try to stop the evil from happening, you label as evil. So I can think in my own lifetime, marriage equality, which I never, you know, would have thought was going to happen. I can tell you that for sure. You know, growing up, struggling with all this stuff at a time when it was a little less out in the open than it is now, and thinking, yeah, someday men and women are going to be able to marry each other. And I thought, that's not going to happen. Let's get real. You know, and the actions that I took to try to help make that a reality. And I knew there were people. I was living in Wisconsin and part of that. And part of us, the reason I was getting active is that Wisconsin, which was, you know, and here's my judgment, Wisconsin, where I'm from, that's my home state. And you know, again, all the stuff I believe in, there are things that I believe in that are part of that state history politically, right? So the progressive movement comes from Wisconsin. Milwaukee had a socialist mayor. So I'm laying all my politics out on the line. I'm sorry about that. But just for me, just saying for me, I'm like, celebrate that stuff. But I grew up in a town that Joseph McCarthy he lived like 2 miles away from where I grew up, you know, and the John Birch Society is from my hometown area as well. I mean, 2 miles away. I can drive past the headquarters to the John Birch Society when I visit my parents' house. It's not that far away from their house. And that stuff would drive me crazy. But so in Wisconsin, then there were, you know, actions that were happening to try to make marriage equality impossible. There was a movement that actually really brought about marriage equality. So think about what Steve's talking about here. That was trying to get state constitutions to make it against the state constitution to allow same-sex marriage to happen. And so there was a lot of activism against it. And in Wisconsin, when I was there, we did that. And I saw guns a-blazing coming after me. And I heard the rhetoric. I knew that I was being viewed as evil, and I didn't think what I was doing is evil, you know. And what's interesting, again, thinking about Steve's saying here, and we can see this, that when we try to keep evil at bay, this is where the problems arise, is that at least the people that were opposing marriage equality, the reaction, once the tide turned, and I go into the history of how that happened, and actually happened here in Minnesota, but once the tide turned, suddenly the impossible happened, and it went from just stopping people from amending state constitutions to actually the legal right for people to be able to marry people of the same gender. So anyway, I just bring that up because for me, that's where I'm like, I didn't think I was engaging in evil, and yet it was easy for me to look at the other side and go, they're engaging in evil. And I have a dear friend who is an evangelical Christian who told me I was going to hell because I was gay. So I knew he didn't like it, and I had to really think. He's a friend of mine, so I had to think about, where is he coming from? What is this about? It's real easy for me to dismiss. Much more difficult to keep that friendship. I don't always say it was difficult. He's a friend of mine. You know what I mean? But it was complicated by that. I remember telling somebody that once, and they said, why on earth are you friends with this person? He just consigned you to the worst thing that his religion believes in. And I just went, yeah, but I don't believe in it. You know what I mean? It's like, no skin off my teeth. I could sit there and make this an awful thing, or I could just try to figure out, where is he coming from? What's going on? Why are we, and then we would engage in conversation about it from time to time. Not too long, because things would get testy pretty fast. But usually that's hard. That is hard. You know, that's the thing with jettisoning the founding fathers, whatever it is. I don't want to get too deep into that. But what we'd rather do, rather than try to see that we're all in this together, is to draw those lines, bring war, and try to oppose and eradicate that evil. As Steve said, this is to avoid seeing totality. And you kind of go, why would we want to avoid seeing totality? I mean, it's what we live in. It doesn't make any sense, but it does. It makes a lot of sense. Because when we see things from perspective of the whole, from the perspective of totality, from the perspective of reality, from the absolute, the things we cling to that give us our sense of an identity, the things that we go, that's who I am. That's the kind of person I am. I said that last night, didn't I? I trimmed a candle and then there's a little lump on it, and I kind of took that off and I said, you don't really have to do that, but that's the kind of person I am. And I looked up and made sure it was all even, That kind of thing that we identify with. That we say, that's who I am. Right? That's those feelings that we have in responding to what we think of as the world out there. We identify with that. We identify with those feelings, the ones that we think are good. Those are the ones we hang on to, that we identify. So we don't want to let go of that. I remember as a young man, I've been a movie buff ever since the movie Star Wars came out. that was the movie that ruined me. I was in junior high. My parents, we watched movies at home on television. If you remember this thing called television, it seems to be very different from the thing that people call television now. Our television was like a piece of furniture. It was one of those console televisions, and so it was like a big wooden thing. And anyhow, my stepdad only watched Westerns, and that made me want to leap off a cliff after a while. But anyhow, when I finally got to see movies on my own, the first one was Star Wars, and that was it. I became a movie buff after that. Then as a young man, I started reading Pauline Kael. I don't know if you know who she is, but really talented writer. She was a film critic for the New Yorker magazine for a really long time. But she's also quite a, what's the word? I'm trying to think of the word that this best conveys. she was very, very opinionated. And I remember seeing her on a talk show. It was Dick Cavett when he was on public television. And she told him that she could not date a man that didn't like the same movies she did. And I remember thinking, well, that seems crazy to me. But her identity was so wrapped up in her movies, in the movies that she loved and the ones that she hated, that she'd rather wage war, than to date somebody or to kind of let her guard down and be open to somebody with a different perspective. So much so that the filmmaker Wes Anderson, if you know who he is, big fan of Pauline Kael's when he was growing up. If you know Wes Anderson, not a surprise because he's a big fan of the New Yorker magazine. But anyhow, when he made his movie Rushmore, he thought, Pauline Kael is going to like this. And she'd been retired for quite a few years at this point. So he rented a movie theater just for her. And it invited her down to see this movie. And she couldn't even be generous at that moment. He goes, after the movie was done, and he was sure she was going to love it, he goes, "So what do you think of my movie?" And she goes, "I don't know, Wes." So that's it. We'd rather call down war upon ourselves. We'd rather hurt somebody than to give up our ideas of ourselves. Sometimes. And notice those ones to which you don't really want to let go of. And those are usually the ones that we associate with being good. I don't want to let that one go. That's a good one. That one, so just watch that. Nobody's asking you to, like completely upend your personality or the way you think about yourself. But it really is what our practice is, just to notice you're doing that. To what are you hanging? Just as we keep noticing, that's when we start seeing that the stuff that we cling to is actually the stuff that we can't hang on to for a whole lot of reasons. First of all, it's not really there in the way we think it is, so we can't even hang on to it at all. But the other thing is that it's often the thing that's weighing us down. So we want to just see what it is that we're doing here. And that's what Steve is pointing out here, is that when we have that experience of out there, all that stuff I just described, it's all showing up. It's all showing up. Because when there's a sense of out there, there's a sense of me here. And again, the ideas we have about ourselves can be very subtle. And we might not even know we're hanging on to them until they get challenged. When I first took up the Zen practice, I thought, I was anti-religious. I can honestly say that. I wasn't an atheist. But I honestly thought only idiots believed in any kind of religion. That's just the way I was, and I was kind of a jerk about it. I remember people getting upset when I would talk about religion, and I look back at it now, and I'm not proud of it at all. I was really a jerk. I was being evil. So when I took up this practice, I came into it with huge skepticism about religion, and then thought, I'm not going to do that. Like my friend, the evangelical, I'm not going to be in that position. And then somebody started challenging Buddhist ideas, and I couldn't believe my heart was pounding, and I wanted a fight, And I just went, well, that's interesting. So this stuff can be very subtle, and you may not notice it until you encounter its limit, where it is that it ends. And Steve continues, he says, were we to see the world as it is, however, thoughts of good and evil simply would not arise. Consider the, I already read that, so let me, get to the next section here. The fact is that we're always in. So again, where we ended is we'd rather call war down upon ourselves. And then Steve goes on to say, though, the fact is that we're always in and part of totality. We cannot remove ourselves or anything else, any thought, anything from it. If we were to see this, we'd have a completely different take on this matter of good and evil, one that would cease to embroil us in pain and confusion. This is not to say that we don't experience things that are painful or sorrowful or difficult. But the awakened mind, which sees all experience as a whole, doesn't see evil as such. It doesn't interpret existence as something out there that threatens me. By the same token, it doesn't see good out there either, as something apart and separate. In awakening to our experience as a whole, we realize that it's this kind of thinking that is the problem. Here is the root of all our sorrow, pain, suffering, and confusion. And to me, it was interesting that the word root came up here after we looked at eradicate. So if the problem of eradicating evil, is that we usually think there's evil out there that we need to destroy, we can really see that the problem with eradicating evil is that we don't really see reality as it's taking place. It's in awakening to our experience as a whole that we realize this way of separating the world is the problem, and that is the root of all our sorrow, pain, suffering, and confusion. So the root is in that way that we have of buying into the appearances that the world is separate. You know, so then we get back to the monkeys, the Japanese monkeys, though, who are writhing and, you know, reacting to evil. It's this evil that makes us react that way. It's the sense that what we're seeing is not right and that it needs to be eradicated, that this can't possibly be happening. Boy, I've had that thought go through my head in a couple moments where things just were not good. This can't be happening. And yet, here it is. You know, it is happening. Somebody told me a story. Somebody goes to Dharma Field about being on a boat. He was trapped in ice. He was going around Greenland, I think, with the idea that he was going to boat down into Iceland. And then he found himself, him and his friends, frozen in ice. Well, how are they going to get rescued? You know what I mean? Like, and I know that if I was on that boat, I'd have been going, this can't be happening. This can't be happening, right? So when that stuff shows up, you know, that's the monkeys. Right? That's what Steve is helping us to see here. Then we, you know, whatever, that this can't be happening. Whatever it is, this is impossible. This is evil. All kinds of labels we put on it. The one we're talking about right now is evil. But it's just in perceiving, not perceiving, because that's, Steve uses the word perception in a very particular way, but we think it's perceiving. So when we are conceptualizing our experience in conceiving evil, then we're responding. Then we have that kind of real, profound disease. What we're going to look at tomorrow, oh, no, it's here. It's in this reading. The Buddha calls misery. You know, that again, we might not go through our lives and go, yeah, I'm in misery. Maybe we do. Maybe we don't. I don't know. But that misery is coming from these ideas, these phantoms that come from phantoms, as Steve says, that we buy into, that we see as having substance that are out in the world. And so then we see then that seeing evil in the world arises from this sense of separation. Seeing evil in this world is the problem that we're having. And so we might hear this and hear that, oh, okay, seeing evil. See, it's these monkeys, they're seeing evil, hearing evil, then either speaking evil or just talking about the fact that there's something evil out there. That's the problem. All I got to do is just stop seeing evil. That's it. And this is a common way that we think of doing things. If you think about stop seeing evil, that is what Steve was talking about earlier, which is our attempts when there's evil to keep it at bay. So now we're going, well, I realize that the real evil is evil, so I'm going to keep evil at bay. I'm going to stop seeing evil. This is a little bit like when you're sitting in meditation and you hear the teaching, right? So you sit and they go, now, when a thought appears, notice that the thought has arisen and return to your breath, right? This is the teaching that we get right at the beginning. This is like meditation, sitting meditation practice 101, right? You find your mind lost in thought, return your attention back to your breath. And I know what that sounded like to me when I started. I was like, oh, we don't think. Thinking is bad. Right? And of course, then you hear teachings about conceptualization and what I'm just talking about, how we layer the world with these concepts we have. And so that's wrong. That's bad. So I got to stop doing that. Got to stop thinking. So whenever I had a thought in my head, I'd try kicking it out of my head. But that's not what the teachings are teaching us. So we don't actually stop seeing evil, or we don't stop thinking by stopping thinking. Because then you're just going to be chasing your tail. That's all that happens with that. It was funny. I've been sitting meditation for, you know, not a long time, but longer than most people. I've been doing it for almost 50. That's 15 years, basically. And still, there were some crows. I was telling, what was I telling you about that? Wasn't I the crows? Oh, you were here, weren't you? There were these crows outside the window. And they just, you know, and it was just like really noisy. I mean, I know what tree they were sitting in. It was basically right across from this window. And then they were cawing at the top of their lungs. And so, you know, you're sitting and that sound arises. And then without doing what I'm going to do. You don't even have to go where I'm going. But I just went, oh, crows. And then I went, oh, you know, again, I'm not doing all this in these words, but then I'm going, oh, I just identified that as crows, right? And it was almost like I was going to stop identifying as crows. And then, ah, God, and they were making so much racket. I went, oh, and they must be surrounding an owl right now because they're really making a heck of a racket. Until I started hearing the other crows. So they were going, caw, caw, and then in distance here, caw, caw, and then caw, caw, and then caw, caw. And then I'm going, okay, so they're communicating with one. So I'm doing all this stuff. And then I'm going, wait a minute, look at what you're doing, you know. And then I'm at times trying to actually kick the thinking out, which is just going, oh, yeah, notice that you're kicking the thinking out. It's only when you do this, which is then I just settled into what was taking place. And then guess what? All that thinking just... it was gone. It was not. I think it's next. It's going to be tomorrow's talk, I think, where we'll talk about letting go and what letting go is and the misconceptions people have of letting go. But to let go isn't to just stop seeing evil, because that is just going to get you in a circle. Even if you think you can stop doing it for a while, that's still a thing called evil that you're stopped seeing, right? That you're doing the monkey. You're going, oh, there's no evil anymore. But in the meantime, your whole thought process still has the word evil in there. So it's really about coming back to this, coming back to now. And Steve talks about that in the next section of this chapter. He says, this is why in the Dhammapada, the Buddha gives us the admonition to purify our own minds. And that's the last place we may want to look, but it's only here that we can live freely in the world without seeing others or ourselves as evil. So just want to pause for 1 second and then I'll continue reading. But it is, he says, perhaps the last place that we want to go, you know, is to look at ourselves. Because at this point, it seems like there's something out there that really needs addressing. So the fact that we're going to look to ourselves almost doesn't make sense. It seems to be the opposite of what we need to do. So we don't want to do that. You go, well, it's not my fault. I'm not the one causing the problems. And the question is, well, aren't you? Aren't you? Anyhow, Steve says, our very quickness to express things in terms of good and evil is what creates divisiveness and human misery. When we see this, we can begin to act wisely. When we catch ourselves adrift in our divisive thoughts, or when we get caught up in our judgments about them or us, we can bring ourselves back to this. All we need is a little bit of attention, a little bit of reflection, and a little bit of patience. See confusion as confusion. Acknowledge suffering as suffering. Feel pain and sorrow and divisiveness. Experience anger or fear or shock for what they are, but you don't have to think of them as evil, as intrinsically bad, as needing to be destroyed or driven from our minds. On the contrary, they need to be absorbed, healed, made whole. Like ourselves, whatever we may want to call evil is already a part of the whole and cannot be removed. To see in this way is to purify your own mind. Now, I have the Dhammapada brought up here. One thing I wanted to point out before I start talking about the Dhammapada is there's this passage here that I may have accidentally skipped over, which starts this way. According to the Buddha Dharma, the teaching of the awakened. I know I did skip over this, so let me get to that. Our effort is to live fully and compassionately in this world of muddy water without churning it up all the more. To do this, we only need to realize that whatever comes our way is already of the whole and cannot be done away with. We need to take care of it on this ground where we find ourselves. This is not to condone whatever brutality, rage, vengefulness, or destructiveness may arise. If there's confusion, maybe we can shed a little light. If there's pain, perhaps we can do something to ease it. If there's violence, it may be possible to absorb it while also doing what we can to reduce it. The first thing you need to do, however, is to observe your own mind. We need to see that we're not, and we're never, never were, and never will be, separate or removed from others. We need to look at our own minds honestly and dispassionately, noticing how they lean toward and away from the innumerable distractions and concepts they imagine. So sorry, I didn't mean to jump to the Dhammapada. I just had a note in here saying something about the Dhammapada, and I went, oh, I'm already at that point, but I'm not. We're at this according to the Buddha Dharma. Our effort is to live fully and compassionately in this world of muddy water without churning it up all the more. And this is important. This is where Steve uses the word compassionate and compassion. And I know from time to time people will say, well, I don't hear Dharma Field talking about compassion very often. I talk about seeing. You know, we talk about knowing. We talk about observing our minds. But the two are not separate from one another. So Steve has this. It's to live fully and compassionately. To live compassionately is to live fully. It is to actually see that this reality that's showing up is full and total, that it's not this fragmented world. When discompassion arises, when conflict arises, it always comes out of a sense that the world is separated and that there are those out there and not us. So to see wholly is to live compassionately. To live fully is not to reject what it is that's showing up. And that's what our tendency to do. That's when we call something evil, we're rejecting it. We're saying this is not, should not be happening. We've got to take care of this. And as Steve says, to have that insight isn't to condone it. So it's not to condone whatever it is that we're labeling evil. As he says, it could be brutality, rage, vengefulness, or destructiveness. It's not to condone that. And I think sometimes people hear that when they hear the teaching of the awakened. It's easy to mistake. A couple ways that people do this, actually. I've heard this. One way is that people say that Buddhism is too optimistic or too idealistic, meaning that when something bad happens, the understanding, and it's wrong, I'll just tell you this right now, it's a misunderstanding. But the understanding is that what the Buddha Dharma is telling you is, oh, you don't see that as bad. So you don't see that as bad, and you instead see it as, well, since our minds are already going bad and good, it's good. It's good. So this bad thing that's showing up, the Buddha Dharma is telling me, if I understand this, I don't see that as bad. So it's a good thing. It's sort of like a teaching I heard the Dalai Lama express, where he was talking about China. And he said, yeah, well, you know, I'm actually grateful for the Chinese. I see them as great teachers. I was telling my evangelical friend about this, and he goes, yeah, I'm sure that's what he believes. But, you know, if you see what it is that Dalai Lama is talking about, and you can actually see the authenticity in his expression of that, you know, when he expresses it. But he's not, the thing that my friend automatically took is that, okay, the Buddhism is all about just taking stuff and putting a positive spin on it. That we don't see evil, we see good instead, we don't see the crap that's going on in our lives, you know. But that's not it at all. That's not what Buddhism is asking. In fact, there's a great teaching by Walpola Rahula. He's talking about the Buddha. He goes, Buddha wasn't a pessimist. So that's another way that Buddhism is frequently looked, ah, the first noble truth is suffering. What kind of a religion is that? You know, I have all this joy in my life and you guys are looking at the suffering. So sometimes it's seen as pessimistic and then sometimes it's seen as optimistic as, well, we don't see bad things. Everything's good. The Chinese are my teachers. You know what I mean? Like, well, the people who are punishing me are actually teaching me things about life. Put the rosy glasses on. I remember somebody telling me, I can't do that sometimes. That's okay. That's not what Buddhism is about. Rahula says Buddha wasn't a pessimist or an optimist. He was a realist. And just come back. That labeling something evil or labeling something bad, that's not necessarily realism. That's just a label you're putting on something. So just be aware that you're labeling it. Buddha's not saying condemn the labeling. Buddha's saying pay attention to what's going on right now. Right now, if there's something evil that's out there, you've just labeled it that way and you're probably responding to something. So what is the response? So all this is just paying attention. paying attention to what's arising. And I think what Steve also points out here is another way that Buddhism is often misunderstood, and that it advocates quiescence, right? So it's that same sort of thing. If I don't see something bad in the world, well, then I'm just supposed to accept it. I mean, that's what this whole thing about being with it is. You know, and you'll hear accept what it is that's showing up. So I'm just supposed to accept these bad things? Isn't that the original reading of the three monkeys that are hiding themselves from the evil that's going on out there? But again, that's not what Buddhism is advocating at all. So it's not quiescence. It's to see what's actually taking place and to act then out of what's actually taking place, not your ideas of it, but what's actually taking place in a way that's not going to churn up more muddy water. We already live in this world of muddy water. We're already confused. So the least we can do is not add to the confusion and not stir up more mud so that it's going to take even longer to at least get some degree of clarity that's going on there. Now, how do we do that? We do that by watching our minds. That's the thing that I told you Steve kind of directs us back to, and most of us are like, oh, I don't want to do that. Why don't we want to do that? Because we want to blame the stuff out there. Because then we say, well, all I have to do then is A, B, C, take these three steps and the thing's taken care of, rather than go, oh, it's my response. And it's in every moment. Oh, shoot. I don't get to take care of this for good. I have to do it in every moment. I have to pay attention. What is going on in my mind? What's going on in our mind? And to do it in a way that doesn't judge what's going on in our mind. And saying that, not to judge what's going on in our mind, to also not try to stop judging, right? So all of that, that gets into that mind game stuff. So that gets us then to the Dhammapada, which is to, he tells us the admonition to purify our minds. And you know the verse, Steve cites it. It's to avoid what is unwholesome, to cultivate what is wholesome, to purify one's mind. This is the teaching of the awakened. And just to let you know, this verse is frequently translated. I'll give you a different translation. To avoid all evil, to cultivate good, and to cleanse one's mind. That's a different translation. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So you go, okay. As you read this verse, you go, it says good and evil right in there. But this is just a problem of translation. It really is. Buddhism isn't interested in good and evil. They exist as phantoms in people's minds, but it's not something that actually shows up in the world. So Buddhism doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about that. The way that evil is helpful, I had talked about this in a class. Were you in that class where Mary mentioned how evil might actually be a useful word?
I don't recall that.
Yeah, and it was kind of startling, but I knew exactly what she's talking about. Because when you say unwholesome, it kind of removes it from the muck of life. Right, so avoid what is unwholesome, knowing that that unwholesomeness can cause pain and confusion in others, just like the stuff we call evil. So to call it unwholesome, she thought, kind of removed it a little bit from the impact that it can have in this world, the stuff that we would label evil. And to cultivate what is wholesome is the stuff that doesn't churn up the muddy water, the stuff that is about transforming all that is painful and hurtful into something else. And that does seem good, but just avoid those labels. And we do that by purifying one's own mind. And that purifying one's mind, and I'm almost at the end of my talk here, that purifying one's mind isn't what I think people think that purifying one's mind is when they might first take up this practice, which I think I alluded to already, which might be the idea that no thoughts should go through my mind at all. That's purifying my mind. You know, no, that's being a zombie. That's not purifying your mind. Thoughts are going to arise. That's what happens with humans. We have these brains, you know, and they're wonderful. All kinds of stuff is perceived by our brains, by our minds, really. And so we are going to have thoughts. They're going to arise. So to purify one's mind isn't to blast out all thoughts and be a zombie. It doesn't mean to not have any emotions. You hear this thing where they talk about not being swept away by emotions. And people take that then as, so I'm not supposed to cry? We'll talk about this. This is actually, tomorrow's talk has got a section about this. I'm not supposed to cry when I feel sad, or I'm not supposed to get angry? If you're thinking supposed to or should, you're already not talking the Buddha Dharma. You're already not looking at what the teachings are, because this is not about supposed to be or should. It's about what is arising and seeing it clearly for what it is, not for what we take it to be. So to purify one's mind, then, isn't to get rid of all thoughts and emotions. It's not just to think positive things, you know. So I don't think bad things. Purifying my mind is just to be goody-two-shoes all the time. Okay, go for it, but that's not what purifying your mind is. Purifying one's mind is to realize this or thus as it is. And I put the word accept in here, to accept it as it is. But that accepting is really just to live this without treating it as separate, without interpreting it as separate, without then trying to keep it as separate from us. And we really have problems. So when we start thinking in terms of them, or you, or her, or him, we can watch our minds. So when we start thinking in those terms, we can watch our minds, see what we're doing. That's what I did when my friend wrote me that message, and I just went, "Pah!" I mean, it really startled me. And a whole lot of stuff flooded into my head, and I had to look at how I was responding, just how I was responding. I didn't have to correct it. It did correct what I was going to say to him, actually, or how I was going to say what I said to him. Once my initial, "Oh my God," you know, once I got over that. But I did that by noticing that that was my first. It was like something just filling a void, you know, just went right in there. And to see that, that immediately was my reaction. That's what we do. So it's just to see, and in seeing, we're seeing that's what's showing up right now. Do you see? That confusion is what's showing up right now. And how did I know that? Because of the way I was thinking about it. Immediately could see what was going on, just by the way I was thinking about it. And just step back, and all of a sudden there was some clarity in what was going on. And that clarity is seeing, again, how there is no good or bad inherently, or how there is no evil and good, however you want to term it. And so to eradicate evil is actually to start seeing that. Because then there is no evil. Then there's nothing that we're going to be responding to. And that is my talk. I don't know if you have any questions or comments. Great, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.